Thank you all for being so prompt. It means that we can have a good exchange during the hour and a half that we have until 7:30. I have to simply explain that this isn't just a short formal exchange between us, but it's also possible afterwards to have some informal contact, certainly with some, if not all, of the people on the platform afterwards at the reception in the Robinson Room, which is open to all of you to come to at 7:30, which will go on for at least an hour. So you are very welcome on that occasion. You have before you half a dozen people who are, as it were, representative of the Center for the Study of Human Rights. This has been a new program of research, public events, and teaching, which has been established at the London School of Economics. It is now really only in its first full year of development, and has already a string of events that has been sponsored in the last months and weeks. This is a particular opportunity for many students and staff interested in the development of human rights across the world to attach to the events that we all know about in September. And we're going to try to introduce the different strands of the topic as crisply as we can so that we have at least half an hour, if not three quarters of an hour, to spare for you to put your questions and your cross-examination. We're going to start. I better explain that my name is Peter Townsend, teaching here partly on child rights at the LSE. And from my right, you probably know, many of you, some others on the platform, but I better explain. Fred Halliday, Roger Silverstone, Christine Chinkin, Kate Mallison, and Francesca Klug. These are the people on the platform who are now going to speak. And I call first of all on Christine Chinkin, who is Professor of International Law and also very much at the heart of the work that we're doing in the Center for the Study of Human Rights. Christine.
Thanks, Peter. Right, I'm looking at the gender aspects of human rights out of the events from September the 11th. I'd like to start with a paragraph from the Boston Globe a couple of weeks ago while the bombing campaign was underway. Quote, "There's a photograph on my desk that's been here for a week now. It's a newspaper portrait of Afghan tribal leaders gathered at a Pakistan border town to plan for a post-Taliban government. Picture shows a diverse group of elders, colorful in their turbans, varied in their robes of their clans. What's wrong with this picture? You see, among all these elders, indeed among 1,500 leaders who assembled, there isn't a single woman. Those who were deciding the shape of the negotiating table had already decided that there would be no women at that table." So in the spirit of this, I then examined The Guardian for November the 14th, which was the day after the fall of Kabul. 13 pictures in The Guardian, color pictures, all aspects of what was going on. There was one of a woman broadcaster on the front page. All the others, so that's the other 12, fighters entering the city in tanks, people celebrating, people looting, people dying, people being shaved, people patrolling the streets, people listening to music, flying kites, not a single woman. There was a cartoon. The cartoon depicted almost inevitably the burqa and comments around that. And then following over the weekend, huge numbers of pictures in the various press, all centering around the burqa, taking the veil off, that aspect. It was almost as though somehow the whole issue of women in Afghanistan has become absorbed into this notion of their dress. Well, of course, the issue of gender human rights in Afghanistan is much more complex, both than the invisibility of women, their silence, and their dress. And in 8 minutes, I clearly can't do it justice. So what I want to do is just very briefly make some points about women and human rights in Afghanistan, both pre-September 11th, then over the period of the conflict, and then very quickly looking forward, well, the conflict, the period of the military campaign. Well, Afghanistan has never been a sort of model jurisdiction for the protection of women's human rights. But I think it's extremely important that we do not see women in Afghanistan as solely victim of human rights abuses, as has been the recent picture. Throughout the 20th century, they did gain, through their own efforts, quite some considerable protection of human rights. In 1964, women were instrumental in drafting the Constitution. In the late 70s, they were instrumental in drafting the United Nations Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And even before the Soviet invasion, which is often presented as being the high spot for women in Afghanistan, there were women in parliament, in the cabinet, diplomats, judges, universities, doctors, teachers, etc. It's also important, of course, not to essentialize women in Afghanistan. There were major differences depending, for example, on the rural-urban divide, and so very many different experiences for women. However, since the Soviets left in the 1990s, conflict from 1992 onwards, it is clear that the position of all women has seriously declined. Before the Taliban victory in 1996, the Mujahideen forces that were armed and trained by the United States government and included those who became both part of the Taliban and of the Northern Alliance waged a brutal war against women. In fact, some people have argued that while it was an exaggeration to say the war was fought over the status of women, this is not an entirely untrue statement. Women, the weapons of war were rape, torture, abduction, forced marriage. Large numbers of refugees, of course, left Afghanistan, and depending upon where they went to, had similar treatment elsewhere. Sort of replication of life in refugee camps, repeating many of the same restrictions on them as back in Afghanistan. Now, of course, as is totally well known and is now getting reported quite considerably, the victory for the Taliban meant the most total denial of the most fundamental human rights for women, where oppression and subordination of women were part of the very ideology of the Taliban. When the sort of now notorious pictures of John Simpson walking into Kabul last week that we've all seen, I must admit I nearly threw something at the television set, when he said, well, you know, human rights in Kabul have been absolutely appalling, and this is what we're celebrating by the liberation. And he then went on to say women were denied education, men were not allowed to shave, and music was forbidden, as though those were sort of equal type things. True, and UNESCO has just announced a figure of some 88% illiteracy rate for women in Afghanistan. But, of course, focusing just on the notion of being denied education fails completely to give the true picture of what was happening to women. Women were 54% of the population after the years of male deaths during combat. They were essentially subjected to an ongoing reign of terror, denial of the most basic forms of human rights, and even the right to life. And there are numerous examples that can be given of that. But I think what we need to also remember is that the situation of women in Afghanistan during the Taliban years in fact received remarkably little attention other than from women's groups in the West. Despite appropriate rhetoric, for example, in General Assembly resolutions, Security Council resolutions, the United Nations itself compromised its own principles of sex equality. No sanctions were ever imposed against the violations of human rights. Certainly no consideration was ever given to use of force, such as humanitarian intervention, to prevent these violations. Instead, the grip of cultural relativity, that is, the notion that how a state treats its women is an internal matter of religion and culture, lessened the external criticism and favored accommodation. Indeed, just for one example, a 1998 memorandum of understanding between the United Nations and the Taliban government on the operation of humanitarian operations in Afghanistan includes the following provisions. Quote, the authorities and the United Nations will make efforts to increase the participation of men and women in health, education, and food supply. Both parties, that's the UN as well, acknowledge the specific cultural traditions that make this goal challenging, delivery of food, delivery of healthcare. As a result, women's access to and participation in health and education will need to be gradual. It's almost impossible to think of the UN compromising basic principles of equality for any other group, which they were prepared to do in the case of women. Indeed, it's been commented that the Taliban's destruction of the ancient Buddhas attracted far more vehement international protests than all the official statements of disapproval of the treatment of women put together. I think it's not too far-fetched to say that September 11 showed in many ways how remaining silent about the position of women also meant ignoring the visible signs of further terror. Again, to quote, "The situation of women in Afghanistan was a clear clue to the complicity of the Taliban in terrorism. Women were the canaries in the mines. The very visible repression of force failing and loss of hard-won freedoms coexists naturally with a general disrespect for human rights. Repression of women is not about religion. It is a tool for achieving and consolidating power." And then, of course, with terrorist acts that went further and beyond just the treatment of women. So what's the situation now after the, during the continuation of the bombing, but now when it looks as though the end of that phase may be coming? On the one hand, the position of women is now becoming higher profile as part of the public litany of justifications for the removal of the Taliban. But it's also been noticeable that while the military campaign was going on, very few women were involved in decision-making, diplomatic, media, and expert commentary, both in the West as well as elsewhere. Treatment of women in other countries deemed essential to the coalition has been discounted. Militarized masculinity was the order of the day during the campaign. And now, sort of looking towards the future, it has to be recognized that in many instances, the end of conflict has not meant the end of violence and human rights abuses for women, which take many different forms. Increased domestic violence is very common at the end of conflict. The massive rapes and sexual attacks in Kuwait that accompanied the liberation from Iraq. The enormous increase of trafficking in women and girls across the Balkans in the aftermath of conflict there. So often, the situation for women has been that there has not been liberation and equality. Women in Algeria, Ethiopia, Nicaragua, Vietnam could all testify to that. While there's been a great deal of discussion for the need for a multi-ethnic, cross-political regime in Afghanistan, there has not been so much attention to the role of women in the new regime. I think there's perhaps three obstacles to this. Put very crudely, women did not hold the guns, were not the leaders in the conflict, are not seen as part of political life. The illiteracy rate that I already mentioned may well now hold against them and taking positions of leadership and responsibility in reconstruction. And then, of course, remains the religious and cultural context of any new government. However, against all the odds, and with a courage that we can only marvel at, women in Afghanistan were not silenced, nor were they completely cowed. The RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women in Afghanistan, was formed in 1977, remained active throughout all of the vagaries of Afghanistan history since then, and in particular documenting atrocities so that the truth will not be kept silent. Throughout the bombing campaign after September the 11th, despite having perhaps the most to gain from the downfall of the Taliban, members of RAWA have argued that they feared the bringing of the down of the Taliban by force and its replacement by another religious-based group. They have urged women's inclusion in the talks and reconstruction as part of the general human rights of public participation. A delegate appeared before the Security Council arguing this case. She stated, "I have often heard that Afghan women are not political, that peace and security is man's work. I am here to challenge this notion." Also, the case has been argued to Brahimi, the UN Special Envoy, charged with building a broad-based government in Afghanistan. So we just don't know at this point. There have been some less than encouraging signs. A senior US administration official was quoted in the New York Times that, quote, "We have to be careful not to look like we are imposing our values upon them." The Security Council has made no promises in response to the appeal that was made. In the resolution of November the 14th, again after the fall of Kabul, it was very noticeable that the Security Council expressed the need for a future Afghan government to respect the human rights of all people within the country, regardless of gender and spelled out gender. But this was in a separate paragraph from where the Security Council also reiterated its support for a broad-based multi-ethnic government that is fully representative of all Afghan people. This paragraph made no explicit mention of women. Indeed, it is possible that the very extremism of the Taliban may make compromise on the position of women's human rights now appear more reasonable. Further, I think it has to be said that the record of the West in ensuring women's human rights in the aftermath of conflict has not been good, even while the language of democracy and human rights is central to the legitimacy of the process. So, for example, Kuwait, the Dayton Peace Agreement, are in many ways problematic for the human rights of women in those societies. Further, of course, the presence of international peacekeepers has long been associated with prostitution, rape, and further abuse of women. Cambodia, Somalia, Bosnia are all examples of that. This, of course, then raises the issue of gender training of such forces, which again, given the need for urgency and speed, may well be put back as less of a priority. So where we're at, I think, is as a strong issue of social justice, reconstruction of women's human rights, there has to be an insistence upon their inclusion in the future processes, but looking at other instances of similar societal reconstruction, I'm somewhat pessimistic. Thank you.
Kate Mallison is teaching in the law department, and she's also in the Mannheim Center for the Study of Criminology and Criminal Justice. She's written a book recently on the new judiciary. Kate.
I was going to have a look at the domestic situation in the light of the events of September the 11th. In Parliament yesterday, we saw a very heated debate during the second reading of the Anti-Terrorism, Crime and Security Bill, which is the government's legislative response to those events. The Act is very much a ragbag of provisions, very wide-ranging provisions, covering a whole different set of areas, including incitement to religious hatred, freezing of assets, retention of internet data, international corruption, police powers, and many others. It's got 125 clauses. It's been drafted in a number of weeks. And I think the speed at which it's been drafted is partly explained by the fact that many of the provisions were already conceived of, at least in outline, because they were provisions that had already been proposed, debated, and rejected on the grounds that they were either unworkable or disproportionate or unnecessary. So I think it's fair to say that the government is using these unusual circumstances of political consensus to pull together a number of provisions which ordinarily it would be very unlikely to succeed in passing through Parliament. And of course the most significant of those provisions is the new power for the Home Secretary to detain foreign nationals who are suspected of terrorism without trial. The provisions allow the Home Secretary to certify that he believes that a person's presence is a risk to national security and that he suspects that that person is an international terrorist. And the term international terrorist is very widely defined. It includes having links with somebody who is themselves a member of an international terrorist organization. It's intended that this will operate in circumstances where the Home Secretary would normally deport a person, but to do so would be to send them to a country where they might be tortured or killed, and that therefore would be a breach of Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights. There is an appeal against the Home Secretary's decision to a Special Immigration Appeal Commission, which is chaired by a High Court judge, and that detention must be reviewed by the Commission every 6 months. Judicial review of the Commission's decision is, and the Home Secretary is specifically excluded by the Act, though there is a right to appeal on a point of law. A person may also be denied representation by his own lawyer and instead be forced to use a special advocate, that's a lawyer who's got security clearance, and hearings can be in private. So clearly this provision raises very acute human rights issues, the most obvious of which is that it almost certainly breaches Article 5 of the European Convention on Human Rights, that's the right to liberty. The debate about the implications of Article 5 have been, I think, depressingly ill-informed. The opening gambit by the leader of the opposition was to declare that the Human Rights Act, which incorporated the European Convention on Human Rights into domestic law and came into force less than a year ago, that should be either repealed or amended. David Blunkett, the Home Secretary, obviously did not want to be seen to be being out-toughed on anything to do with terrorism or in any way pandering to, in his words, the airy-fairy civil liberties lobby, and so he did not come to the defence of the act passed by his government. There was therefore a moment several weeks ago when it looked quite likely that the Human Rights Act, a very long fought for reform in human rights, was about to be binned. There was a frantic period of lobbying and briefing, and the government was persuaded that the Human Rights Act did not, in fact, prevent it from introducing any emergency provisions, and indeed that repealing or amending the Act wouldn't actually solve their problem, because the problem lay in the European Convention itself. What the government's decided to do, therefore, is to derogate from the European Convention, from Article 5. This is allowed under Article 15 of the Convention. It's allowed in times of war or public emergency threatening the life of the nation, insofar as it is strictly required by the situation. So that's quite a high test, at least on paper. And the question, therefore, is to what extent will this derogation, when it goes through, be held to be valid? The Joint Committee on Human Rights of Parliament has rushed through a report on the new bill last week, and it stated that in its view it doubted whether the measures were strictly necessary. On the other hand, if and when this comes to Strasbourg, to the European Court of Human Rights, the case law there suggests that the court tends to apply a very wide margin of appreciation to member states in determining when there is a threat to national security, a public emergency. Certainly the previous derogation by the UK in relation to Northern Ireland terrorism was held to be valid. Of course, the situation here is rather different. The terrorism did not take place in the UK, and of course it's arguable that it affects the whole of Europe, not just the UK, and yet it's the UK alone that is seeking to derogate. The government's answers to that is that we have a specific problem, that there are foreign nationals here who are engaged in terrorism activity, and it is specifically at that group of people, it suggests a relatively small group of people, that this provision is being targeted. It's clear, of course, that the military and political situation is changing very fast at the moment, and it's very difficult to predict if and when this case comes to Strasbourg, which may well be in several years' time, what the decision will be, but I think it's quite possible that by that stage the justification for derogation may be much more difficult to sustain. So I think to sum up, there is quite a lot to be pessimistic about in relation to domestic human rights at the moment. I think this Act is very likely to be passed, perhaps with some amendments pushed in the Lords. The government's made it very clear that it intends to impose a very strict timetable indeed. Debate should be finished by the end of the week. I think one positive note, though, is that the Human Rights Act seems to have survived an extremely difficult challenge, one that I don't think any of us could have predicted a year ago. And I think it's only going to be in the coming months and years, when these provisions come before the court to be reviewed, that we'll really be able to see whether the Human Rights Act is able to restrict the extent to which these statutory provisions actually breach human rights in the UK in practice.
Thank you.
Francesca Klug is the academic director at LSE of a Human Rights Acts research project, which she's undertaking with people outside LSE. She wrote a book recently on the story of the UK Bill of Rights, which is entitled Values for a Godless Age. Francesca.
Thank you, Peter. And I'm going to try to draw out what the human rights principles might be of the recent situation that Kate so eloquently described for us. It gets curiouser and curiouser, as Alice said to the Mad Hatter. First, we are told that we are fighting a war to protect democracy and human rights. Then we are told we have to derogate or opt out of Article 5 of the European Convention on Human Rights, the right to liberty and security, only incorporated into our law a year ago, as Kate explained. We have to opt out of the right to liberty and security as part of a war to protect our liberty and security. First, we are told by the Home Secretary on the 15th of October that there is, and I quote, no immediate intelligence pointing to a specific credible terrorist threat to the UK. And then we are told by the same Home Secretary that we are in the midst of a public emergency threatening the life of the nation, which is so serious that we have to introduce detention without trial, a far more serious measure than we ever used in the UK in the face of IRA terrorism. First, we are told that the war is in self-defence and will ultimately protect us. Then we are told, only last week, again by David Blunkett, that although the military gains are faster and more substantial than most commentators predicted, a wounded tiger is more dangerous than ever. Hence the need to take exceptional measures to protect us. Is it any wonder that some of us are confused about what the human rights principles emanating from September the 11th might be? I shocked a researcher for Radio 4's World at One last week. She was sure she knew what I thought the human rights implications of September the 11th must be when she said, "You must be furious with the government for introducing this emergency legislation after all the work you did on the Human Rights Act." I think she was looking for a soundbite. "This can't be what the drafters of the European Convention on Human Rights had in mind," she said. "But this is precisely what they had in mind," I replied. "What do you mean?" she said. "Well," I said, "the drafters included Article 15, the article which permits derogation from most of the other articles in the European Convention. They included Article 15 explicitly because it recognised an overriding duty on the state to protect democratic institutions and the system of protecting human rights as a whole in the face of attacks against it. In 1978, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that some compromise between the requirements for defending democratic society and individual rights is inherent in the system of the convention. Or as Justice Jackson said in 1949, in a more straightforward American prose, the court should not convert the Constitutional Bill of Rights into a suicide pact. What is more, there's a whole jurisprudence coming out of the European Court of Human Rights on state obligations to protect individuals from serious risks to their lives by other individuals, not just by introducing effective criminal law provisions, but through measures of deterrence as well. And then there are the UN conventions against terrorism, for example, the International Convention for the Suppression of Terrorist Bombing, which obliges states to deny safe havens to people wanted for terrorist bombings and to prosecute them if they are not extradited, exactly what was the dilemma that David Blunkett faces with people he can't extradite and he says he can't prosecute. In other words, it's a major human rights principle that states protect our right to life. A major human rights violation occurred on September the 11th, a crime against humanity, according to most authorities. Human rights philosophy has moved on a long way since the Enlightenment ideal of individuals needing protecting from oppressive states. Post-war human rights philosophy recognizes that states have an obligation to protect individuals from harm as well as to refrain from that harm themselves. And this protection explicitly includes non-state actors as well as states, in other words, criminals and terrorists. Now, it was these principles in mind that I looked at the new Anti-Terrorism, Crime and Security Bill, all 124 clauses of it. A number of notable civil libertarians have said they have no issue with some of the sections concerning weapons of mass destruction or the security of pathogens and toxins. These do not, they say, raise any significant human rights issues. I say they do. They raise the significant human rights obligation of the Home Secretary to plug loopholes in our protection against those who wish to violate our human rights by poisoning or choking us. The Home Secretary has complied with human rights obligation in introducing them. But with the human rights obligations on states to protect us firmly in mind, I still cannot see the human rights justification for declaring that this is a public emergency when none of the other 40-plus European Court of Human Rights signatories have done so. I still cannot see, even if you accept that the Home Secretary is privy to intelligence, which would justify his assertion that this is a public emergency threatening the life of the nation, that indefinite detention without trial is strictly required, the only grounds, as Kate explained, on which a measure under a derogated article is justified. When the Terrorism Act 2000, note I said 2000, it's only just been introduced, the most wide-ranging anti-terrorism act in Europe, the government boasts, allows for the prosecution here of an unprecedentedly wide range of offences, including those committed elsewhere. This was confirmed in the recent case of Raymond. Particularly concerned will be people who have nothing, my particular concern is that people who have nothing to do with September the 11th and may even have genuine, legitimate grievances against their government will be detained indefinitely under this new law. And I still cannot see that ousting judicial review or habeas corpus from the process of reviewing the Home Secretary's decision to detain people, which in turn is based on information provided by the security services, the same security services which failed to predict, along with their counterparts in America, the events of September the 11th, but which once declared Peter Mandelson, Jack Straw, Harriet Harman, and Patricia Hewitt as dangers to the state. I can't see it is in any way necessary to oust the court from the process of reviewing the Home Secretary's decision when they are well used to dealing with national security issues and nearly always defer to the government in any case. But if circumstances were to change, my judgment could change. The human rights spirit must be ever open and ever inquiring. The libertarian position that all actions by the state which reduce the liberty of the individual must automatically be opposed can be respected, but it is not, in my view, a human rights position. Human rights principles recognize that only a very few rights can be applied without qualifications at all times. Torture is one of these. And the Home Secretary's recent affirmation that he would not be prepared to deport people to their certain torture, even if Article 3 of the European Convention of Human Rights didn't prevent this, is at least one clear expression of a human rights principle. We should be grateful for small mercies. It is essential, then, that in opposing the government's measures on human rights grounds, we are clear what human rights principles are. Firstly, because in a world where states cynically quote human rights values for other, usually geopolitical, ends, it is crucial that we do not likewise manipulate human rights principles for whatever cause we happen to espouse. Secondly, because it is unquestionably true that human rights values are not universally accepted, although I would argue that they are universally applicable, never has this been clearer. If we are to win human rights battles without guns and bombs with our opponents, who believe that it is anything less than a crime against humanity to turn planes full of passengers into human bombs to kill other civilians, then it is essential that we are clear about what our fundamental values are and stick to them. And thirdly, if we are interested in being effective and not just right, we must, quite obviously, convince people out there of our arguments. If it is widely believed by the way we express our cause that human rights advocates are only concerned with injustices at the hands of the state and not at the hands of private armies who can inflict even greater terror, we will never win our case, and successive governments will have a free run to go on weakening our rights in the name of protecting them. Thank you.
Roger Silverstone is the Professor of Media and Communications. He's a sociologist, and he has written quite lately a book entitled Why Study the Media? The media have been raised, and I ask him to speak. Roger.
Thank you, Peter, very much. As a few of you will know, and many of you will soon discover, I'm not an expert on human rights. However, I hope what I have to say over the next few minutes will provide a useful perspective on the ways in which the media play a significant role in how human rights are framed and why it seems such a struggle to place human rights and their abuse on national and international agendas in meaningful ways. I want to suggest that there is a structural dimension to the mediation of issues of human rights, which the reporting of the barbaric events of September the 11th illustrate, but which they do not fundamentally alter. September 11 was a crisis, certainly, and a catastrophe, but we cannot understand the media's relationship to it only by focusing on the immediate moment and its aftermath. We have to make sense of this relationship in the broader context of how the media consistently and persistently represent the world to us, how they consistently and persistently represent otherness, other people, other cultures, and in so doing, how they define for us a relationship to the world to which we would otherwise have no access. It is this dimension of the work of the media that bears directly on the representation and definition of human rights. Everyone now has a set of more or less indelible sounds, images, and voices in their heads that mark their own experience and recollection of the reporting of those days. And still, apart from those terrible and initially at least endlessly replayed images of the disaster itself, I have a small number of such moments. The image of George Bush at his first press conference after the attack, and once he had found his way back to Capitol Hill, sitting alongside his generals and his senior colleagues, dressed in what to all intents and purposes looked like a cross between a battle dress and a windbreaker. Was he about to hunt terrorists or bears? The image of the three middle-aged male workers leaving the site of destruction covered in dust, as if, for all the world, they had just been photographed by the National Geographic emerging from a tribal initiation. The voice of John Simpson, the BBC correspondent on Radio 4, not just reporting on, but claiming to be leading the liberation of Kabul, and bringing, as he did so, a whole new sense to the phrase media imperialism. These moments mark, both generally and uniquely, the particular way in which each one of us is enabled to construct his or her own version of events. But our capacity to do so, indeed the media's own capacity to represent them, in the first place, depends on the presence in our culture and in our minds of images that already exist. It was commonplace to say at the very beginning, as reporters and audiences struggled to make sense of what was happening, that this was just like Hollywood. Yet the shocking and the threatening has to be made into sense. Despite the singularly catastrophic moments of September the 11th, the media have a stock of images, frames, and narratives available which will contain as well as explain. The container is the familiar which is there to draw the sting. There is safety in the cliché. That is why it is incorrect to believe that images never lie, and that the press's mortification that there were and still are no pictures coming from the war in Afghanistan, from the real firefighting conflict, that is, should be understood as a more complex issue than it might first appear. Both the immediate image and the live report are unlikely, and we learned this distinctively in the reporting of the Gulf War, adequately to represent an otherwise unmediated reality. Both image and report are constrained by the controls imposed, both legitimately and cynically, by the military and the state, but appear as in some sense a transcendence of those controls. It is, of course, the truth, that in war, truth is the first casualty. But the vividness of the immediate and the live masks the degree to which understanding is genuinely enabled. It masks, too, the fact that the media are indeed hard at work, and that that work involves selection, representation, translation, all of which have material consequences for those of us who, without alternative sources of information and communication, and that includes most of us, gain what we need to know, not just to understand what is happening out there, but crucially, how to place ourselves in relation to it. There are two further points I want to make before addressing directly the question of the representation of human rights. The first has to do with the idea of catastrophe, and the second, the question of distance. The US film critic and theorist, Pat Mellencamp, In writing about the media's reporting of the Challenger disaster on January the 26th, 1986, reflected on the question of what makes a catastrophe. Acknowledging the reality of an event is only the start. Something becomes a catastrophe, she suggests, when reports of its occurrence are allowed to interrupt the otherwise seamless schedules of broadcast radio and television. And conversely, it is that interruption, just before the denouement of a John Wayne movie or an episode of EastEnders, which itself is catastrophic for those whose ontological security is in some small measure requires them to be engaged in the continuous narratives of daily mediation. This is a serious point. It addresses the enormous importance of the continuity of media, the eternity of the schedule, the endlessness of news, to the conduct of everyday life in our intensely mediated societies. It points, too, to the importance of that continuity in massaging the unique and the threatening back into the flow of ordinary everyday time and consciousness. 2 months after September the 11th, and after 4 weeks of anthrax in the Postal Service, two of the three, or perhaps four, major US networks refused to relay President Bush's live broadcast to the nation, his first since the anthrax attack began. NBC, indeed, chose not to reschedule an episode of Friends. In a propaganda war, distance is both friend and enemy. Distance, of course, keeps us away from any possible informed or experiential challenge to the dominant framing of state departments and ministries of information. Yet the further away, both geography and culturally, from its source in those very ministries, the receivers of those messages are, the more likely the terrorists will become freedom fighters, and the more likely that the singularity of the message will be diffused. I have another radio memory of the conflict. It is of an Afghani blacksmith who, having so far failed to hear any of the US airplane-based supposedly blanket radio propaganda coverage of his country, offered his account of why so many bombs were falling around his village. It was because, he thought, Al-Qaeda had killed many Americans and their donkeys and had destroyed some of their castles. He was not entirely wrong. The appearance of Al Jazeera on Western screens was an affront not just because of the appearance of Osama bin Laden in the homes of the Midwest, but because it indicated that they were reporting on us. We had become their other. So to conclude, the reporting and representation of human rights in Western media has to be understood in the defining, if not determining, context of how those media go about their daily business. Both a personal and a political response to human rights and their abuse depends on our ability to recognize and acknowledge that those who suffer, as well as those who perpetrate that suffering, are human beings like us as well as human beings different from us. Their similarity enables us to know them and to judge them. Their difference requires us to recognize that there are things that we may never understand about them. The dominant narratives of Western media tend to refuse this acknowledgement of difference. The others are seen to be either so like us as to be indistinguishable from us, or so unlike us as to be less than human. Insofar as the media frame their reporting of the world through the particular temporal and spatial, visual and narrative frames and filters, some of which I have tried to identify in this brief intervention, the less likely, both in general and in specifics, will we find ourselves having to confront our own humanity and inhumanity. A focus on September the 11th from this perspective will provide illumination but not surprise. If, however, anything is to change, the media and media work must be the focus of sustained and critical examination. I hope I have given some idea of what that examination might involve. Thank you very much.
Finally, Fred Halliday, who is the Professor of International Relations at LSE, and also one of the prime movers of the Center for the Study of Human Rights in the last 2 years. And he has two of his recent books were The World at 2000 and Nation and Religion in the Middle East. Fred.
Thank you very much, Peter, and thank you for inviting me to speak at this very important gathering. let me make two very obvious points. I think as human beings, as all of us confront this, but also with our individual academic interests and country experiences, clearly this is something which challenges all of us at a whole range of levels. It challenges us to explain what has happened. I think it challenges us to think about something most of us don't want to think about most of the time, which are things like hatred and violence. And I think it also challenges us intellectually, whatever our discipline is, whatever anybody's studying here, whatever human rights NGOs people work for, or whatever else they do, one's muscles, as it were, are strained by trying to grasp what happened on September the 11th and also how we respond to it because of the complexity of it. It's much more complex crisis and much more morally and psychologically challenging than, I mean, to give something which is remote to most of you, but not to some of the oldies here, perhaps the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 or the Gulf Crisis of 1990. And I think we all have to begin by recognizing this, also recognize the fact that in many ways we're flying blind. There are lots, I mean, the four previous speakers, one of the themes I picked up in each of their very interesting contributions was uncertainty. And I certainly share that as well. So let me say how I come at this. I come at it, I suppose, with three different hats. One is reflecting the interests of international relations and what an international relations take on this will be, and I'll come to that in a minute. The second is I have worked on a number of Middle Eastern countries. I've worked quite a lot on the variants of interpretation of the Islamic religion. I've been in Afghanistan, and I want to talk about that. I was there 20 years ago during the communist period, and I saw both the costs of the communist reforms, but also what they were trying to do. I mean, my partner and I, we went to Kabul University, and most women there were not wearing any chador or burqa or anything else. They were walking around like students at the LSE. Some were, but most weren't. We went and visited women's literacy classes in provincial towns, for example, in Herat. I remember talking in one ministry to a group of young secretaries who were certainly not wearing any stuff on their hair. They clearly didn't like the communists, but I mean, I speak Persian and they were Persian speaking, and I said, what do you think of the government? And they said, we don't like the communists. And I said, well, what do you think of the Mujahideen? And they said, they're Vahshi, they're barbarians. And we'd much prefer the communists to the barbarians. And I think we have to remember that there is a history of beleaguered but very courageous, as Christine Chinky was saying, feminist movement in Afghanistan, women teachers, women doctors, women engineers, people who've struggled to try and introduce modern values against many odds. And it's very interesting that in the press reporting of recent days, quite a lot of the women who've been interviewed, and there haven't been that many, have said, well, the burqa is one issue, but being allowed to work is also an issue. And I think that that tells one something about the diversity of that society. But I want to begin with what Peter alluded to. I was, for a year, the director of the Human Rights Center. And there were three or four general human rights issues which I think were there before 11th of September, which we need to look at in a new light. And by analogy with the argument about the world recession, I mean, the world recession was starting before September the 11th. September the 11th made it worse. What are the human rights issues which were there before September the 11th, but which September the 11th has taken further? I want to mention four. First of all, in a very broad sense, and without being too pessimistic, I think there was a retreat from a commitment to human rights visible in many different areas around the world before the 11th of September. The most obvious instance of this was the election of the Bush administration. The Australian government was behaving perniciously in the United Nations. The British press was up to its tricks, not least in regard to the work which Kane Mallison and Francesca Klug were talking about, the incorporation of the Human Rights Act. And I was struck by how, on many human rights issues, the going was getting tougher. And I want to just, in what may sound like a trivial way, but a kind of quite pointed way, allude to three people who've been much praised and honored in the last year, who are dyed-in-the-wool opponents of human rights. One is the recently elected mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, who is an anti-feminist fanatic and extremely a strong opponent of equal rights for women. And the fact that he should be taken seriously, the fact that he should be elected mayor of New York, is in itself a repugnant development. The second is the great hero of Wimbledon this summer, Ivan Isic, who went back to Zagreb the night of his victory at Wimbledon and appeared at a public rally with other Croatian sportsmen, saying that the Croatian people indicted by the International Criminal Tribunal with regard to former Yugoslavia were great war heroes and honorable people, and they should not be indicted. The third is the novelist V.S. Naipaul, for whose earlier novels I have great admiration, but who has made it a point to endorse Hindu chauvinism in India. He supported the destruction of the Ayodhya Mosque in 1993. His writings are handed out by Hindu fundamentalists in India. These are people who want to murder Muslims. And who was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature after September the 11th. And I just think these are three very striking examples of where an element of shame and of circumspection about human rights is strikingly absent. Secondly, as the other speakers have said, our understanding of human rights has broadened in recent years. I mean, we conventionally say, you know, human rights 101, as they would say in America, is that it's political rights, it's economic and social rights, and then thirdly, it's collective rights, rights of nations, rights of workers, rights of women, and so forth. But it also includes the Geneva Conventions, the four major conventions of 1949, but also something I'm particularly interested in the Middle Eastern context, but also coming from Ireland, the protocols of 1977, which bind non-state actors. They bind guerrilla groups and liberation movements and transnational armed groups also to certain principles. But I think that very broadening does raise the point that there may not be a simple human rights position on any major question. The more you broaden the agenda, the more you broaden the conventions, as Francesca Klug was saying, the more you bring in issues of order and security of individuals, the more you face difficult choices. There isn't just a simple human rights position. Do you provide food to starving people if you have to give 30% of it to an indicted warlord? Well, if you're a 26-year-old Norwegian corporal in the UN and you have to decide by 10 o'clock in the morning whether or not to do it, either the people starve or you give 30% to the warlord, what do you do? There's no easy answer. Third issue is the issue of cultural diversity. I'm sick and tired of this argument, to be honest, and I like very much what Francesca Klug said. There are universal principles. Everybody in the world knows what a thief is, a liar, a rapist is. Countries are signed up to these things. The idea that there is one alternative cultural answer, there is one Islamic answer or one Buddhist answer or one Confucian answer on gender or on state formation or the economy is complete nonsense. There are a great variety there. One of the great crimes of the Taliban was to give a completely sectarian account of the Islamic view on women or on pictures or anything else. And I think we've gone a bit soft in the head and a bit soft in the word about the role of religion with regard to human rights. I want to put it on the line. Every religion in the world and every god in the world, or wherever these people are, is in violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Let me put it as clearly as that. And until and unless these gods and their self-appointed spokesmen, and nearly all are men, comply, we should not take their claims to authority seriously. I'm fed up with words like sage. All these sages, a lot of, you know, as Christine Chinkin was saying, a lot of old men with beards bargaining with each other. We have to be much more intolerant, I think, of the claims of religion and of community than we have been. And it's a very ironic fact that the best-selling poet in the United States today is a poet called Jalaluddin Rumi. He's a Sufi poet who was born in northern Afghanistan in the year 1207. And he is a cosmopolitan, and he's a mystic, and he's one of the best forms of cosmopolitanism. And he makes the argument very clearly that he is a human being first, and a member of a particular religion second. He is as universalist as you could want anyone to be. And I think that we've bent the stick much too far in deference to particularist claims. And I do think that, if I can put it crudely, some of the political philosophers have run away with themselves and should be stopped. The fourth point I want to make is that in the broadening of the human rights agenda in the last 20 years, we have come more and more to recognize that it's not just states which violate human rights, it's societies, it's families, it's neighbors, it's fathers, uncles, elder brothers, it's caste, it's the neighborhood. And the violations of human rights by society, in violence against women being a very obvious example, but there being many others, and lying and chauvinism and so forth, these are equally important. And I think these four points are relevant to the present context, and let me briefly run through a few points about the present. First of all, from an international relations point of view, obviously the central issue is the question of state authority. To who has authority? Does the United States or Britain or France or does the Security Council have authority to conduct a war against Afghanistan? And I think there is room for legitimate debate about how far the UN resolutions and the UN Charter do provide authority for that which has happened. My own view is they do. I'm much more convinced of the legitimacy of these actions in terms of authority than I was, say, of the Kosovo escapade, although that could be justified on other grounds. But I think there is legitimate debate about that. But one has to ask the non-state actor question, too. By what authority did Al-Qaeda attack New York? By what authority did Al-Qaeda lure tens of thousands of young people from other countries to Afghanistan to die under American bombs? By what authority did they go around slaughtering Shiites and terrorizing women in Afghanistan? If you raise, quite rightly, the question of just authority for the states, we have to raise it for the non-state actors as well. Secondly, the question of the conduct of war itself, this principle of jus in bello. We are right to be concerned about bombing which affects civilians, about cluster bombs, about daisy cutters, about the issues that are being raised in the liberal press here. But what about the attack on tower blocks in a modern city and the indiscriminate slaughtering of civilians? Why does nobody demonstrate about that, I wonder? Why has nobody ever demonstrated against Al-Qaeda and against the Taliban, who are flagrant violators of human rights and of any modern legitimate conception of the rules of war? And particularly now that we see so many people in Afghanistan themselves, they're just as Muslim as anyone else, wanting to throw them off. We should hold the states to account. We should hold the non-state actors to account. And to put this in slightly provocative terms, I'm very happy for there to be an investigation into what the British Army did in Bloody Sunday. But what about all the people, all the kneecappers and sundry assassins and people putting bombs in fish shops in the Falls Road and in the Shankill for the last 30 years? These gentlemen should also be held to account, just as much as the British Army, so that the in bello issue is for states and non-state actors. Thirdly, on the question of cultural values, one of the most striking things, if you read the statements of Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, and the others, is their racism. The most racist statements I have read anywhere in modern political life. 2 weeks after Durban, a conference against racism and xenophobia, we should have these statements attacking Christians and Jews and in a very, in fact, all non-Muslims, in extremely violent terms. Now the Taliban are denouncing what they call the Hunud, the Indians, the Indians and Hindus also are in there with the Jews and the Christians as part of the package of people who are fair game. Again, I think there's too much indulgence of this racism from below, as well, quite rightly concerned about racism from above. But in regard to the legislation, I have to say, being introduced in this country, I am strongly opposed to and have tried to study racism towards Muslims, but in line with what I said earlier, I'm absolutely against any law which makes it a crime or a litigious issue to criticize religion itself. I think the sacred texts of religion are fair game, and let's be clear, all the holy texts are violating the human rights conventions. They're full of misogynistic, homophobic, racist, and other formulations, a lot of them. And if we're going to stop this stuff, then they should be banned, which I'm not in favor of. But don't let them start jumping up and saying, you mustn't criticize us, which I think is wrong. Finally, the issue of gender. One of the issues in human rights is indeed the attitude of gender and feminism to war. There's always assumption that feminism is either near pacifism or is at least much less willing to go to war than masculinism or orthodox IR, and I'm sure that's true. But there are still clear issues on which feminists are prepared to go to war. And I think in this conflict, we've seen an interesting division, a diversity, a healthy diversity, between what you would think of the obvious feminist position, which is negotiate, stop the war, drop food parcels, and so forth, and what I call the Bomb the Burqa Brigade, who've taken up quite the opposite view, which is because of the very seriousness of the violations of women's rights in Afghanistan, we should go there and root them out. And a good thing that some of the pilots, at least flying the American planes, are actually women. And teach the Taliban a lesson. So I think there isn't one feminist take on this, and I think that's something, again, which one has to bear in mind. And finally, just to reemphasize once again what Francesca Klug said, security is also a human right, and for better or worse, the only people who can protect our security are states. They may get it wrong, they may go too far. There are people in our society, and not far from where we sit, who think that we're all fair game, who think that all infidels should be killed, who think that all British tourists in the Middle East should be slaughtered, and they've been saying it for years. Of course, they may not mean it, but I'm not so sure. Thank you.
we do have nearly half an hour before we close the meeting, and it is very much up to you to raise points that you would like to raise in the next minutes. Let me have a show of if you want to ask something. You've got the opportunity of making your voice known around the room.
Right, I won't have to shout like this. I'm Christine van den Anker from the University of Birmingham, and I would like to ask you, one thing that has come across since the 11th of September is the idea that we are at more risk than before the 11th of September, at more risk of networks of terrorists that seem to be prepared to do outrageous things. And some of you, I really enjoyed your talk, some of you hinted at this, but I would like to know your view on whether you think there is more risk and there is a need for the drastic measures that have been taken, both in terms of war and in terms of legislation. And I would like to hold out to you that possibly a mistake was made in the traditional forms of protection that we have from terrorism, and that this mistake has not been recognized, and that the people who are responsible for this mistake need to recognize it as a mistake, but also need to recognize that they did prevent a lot of other planned attacks from happening, and they can still do so without going to war to all states that might harbor terrorists. Thank you.
Thank you. I think in this sharp exchange we'll take three questions or comments and then turn to the panel. Anybody up there? Yes, one at the back. Right in the back. I don't know whether you can actually reach him. Yes, you can. Good.
My name is Nelson Jobim. I would like to ask a question about the U.S. role. Because just after the 11th of September, we've got the impression that the United States wanted to build a coalition, was looking for allies, and now that the war seems to be going a more successful way according to U.S. plans, lots of people are a bit scared that they might leave Afghanistan to the United Nations, and that they are not very interested in really addressing the Palestine question. So I'd like to hear from the panel what has been the, if there was some significant change in the U.S. foreign policy just after the events and now that the war seems to be going their way, and what can we expect from the next states to be targets, whether or not there's going to be war in other countries. Thank you.
Any likely changes in the U.S. foreign policy? I think you had your hand up here.
Thanks. Rachel Cedar from the Institute of Latin American Studies in the University of London. That's a question for Fred, if I might. I very much liked your comments and your trenchant defense of universalism against religious chauvinism. But I wonder what other problems, you yourself pointed to the fact that the Bush administration was a bad sign for the advance of human rights. If we have a government waging this war, not in the name of universalism, but rather, although the language has been toned down of late, of clash of civilizations and sort of Huntington-esque turn of phrase at the beginning, what are the possible consequences of that for the kind of position that you set out in defense of universalism?
Thank you. Those are three good points, and I'll just simply ask the panel to respond. More risk, U.S. policy, consequences of clash of civilizations, if I may flag them. Reactions?
I'm just going to take the first point, which is the only one I really have anything to say about the greater risk. I mean, it's clear that David Blunkett, certainly in the evidence he's given to the Joint Committee on Human Rights, emphasized that there is a much enlarged risk as a result of the 11th. And I think that has got to be a justifiable argument. I mean, clearly that event did change the security situation in itself. I think that is a perfectly sound starting point for the measures that have been taken. I think the problem in terms of the domestic legislation, some of the issues that, Francesca raised, which you might want to talk about, but a lot of it is simply about, are these measures actually appropriate to deal with that risk, that increased risk? Will they do that? And I think that's where there's a much greater question mark about the appropriateness and the validity of the legislation. The fact of the increased risk, I think, is a perfectly valid political judgment to have made.
Christine?
I was going to say something about the US role vis-a-vis the United Nations. I'm sort of not more generally on US foreign policy. And certainly it was true that immediately after September the 11th, they took, they paid some of the back dues, they sent a ambassador to the United Nations, which had been stalled for a long time. And so there was at least an appearance of sort of multilateralism within the UN itself, apart from the coalition building outside. But having said that, it's, I think, very interesting when you actually read the Security Council resolutions, the sort of distancing between the Security Council setting out its package primarily to do with various measures that can be taken against terrorism, such as the financial, chasing financial assets, cutting off monetary supplies, criminal cooperation, etc., and very little engagement with the concept of use of force. There's a preambular reference to the right to self-defense, and that's essentially it. And in other sort of UN type initiatives, the International Criminal Court being an obvious example, there's been no real movement from the US at all. So sort of no indication that, despite in many ways I think the whole event have shown just what would have been the use, potential use of having a permanent International Criminal Court, there's been no, that I've seen, indication that they may be rethinking along those sorts of lines. Kyoto and the protocol environment is another example of that. So I think there's been a sort of minimalist engagement to some extent, but not any sort of further going into the many of the issues that are to the forefront of other policies within the Security Council at the moment. No, I'll leave it at that. Moment.
Fred or Roger? No.
Well, I mean, I want to defer to all the experts in this. I think that just in relation to the three points that were made, one is, I think, in the answer to the question about risk, the answer is we don't know. I mean, it's precisely that we don't know, that we can think about and recognize a certain kind of cynical mobilization of the politics of fear in order to produce a range of legislation. We've already discussed that in a number of Western governments, and it's quite clear that's happening in the United States and the UK. In terms of the US roles in relation to foreign policy, again, I'm not an expert, but what's very striking in the US, I came back from New York last week, is how singular the message is in relation to the mobilization of the domestic population, how little criticism there is available in any of the popular media, and indeed how evident, except insofar as one reads the sort of the back pages of the New York Times and sees references to harassment of Pakistani taxi drivers in New York, and all the other and events of that kind, which are clearly not being widely reported, which suggest a very uncomfortable set of circumstances and conditions. And the third point in relation to the clash of civilizations, what's striking again to me and as a media observer is how easy it has been, despite the disclaimers, for the rhetoric of civilization clash to be mobilized in this conflict. I mean, this is, I think, the last major speech that Bush made. He began by saying, we are now engaged in the defense of civilization.
Fred?
Well, on the question of risk, I think we can't shut our eyes to the fact that there are a group of people in the world who will do what they can to attack Western cities and targets in Western cities, and who have also been doing the same thing in their own societies. I think all communal terrorism and all political terrorism internationally, whether it be the relatively small-scale IRA activities or Tamil Tigers or Palestinian or whatever, reflects violence and conflicts within these countries. And I think the record of these people, Bin Laden's group is a good example, they've been at it for a long time, killing people in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in other countries. Therefore, their record is clear. And I'm afraid the conclusion one has to come to is they would if they could. do whatever it has been said they could do. Then the question becomes, how capable are they? Are not the security systems we have in place sufficient without all this extra law to prevent them happening? And I think that there's an argument one could make of that, but not by diminishing the threat or saying that it's invented. And I think it is pertinent to make the point that, in general, people feel much more insecure if they live in tower blocks, if they hear planes. People are staying at home much more. The two growth areas in developed societies for the West now are takeaway, home delivery pizzas and home videos. And how long that will last, one doesn't know, but there is a very pervasive sense of melancholy and concern, and were there to be another significant attack, it would get much worse. On the question of the American role, I'm not optimistic at all about the United States or the West in general solving in any serious way any of the multiple issues that lay behind this crisis, be it Palestine or Kashmir or Iraq or anything else. There may be some places where something will change. America's relations with Sudan is an example, and opening to Iran. But I'm not at all optimistic about that. On the other hand, I think we should be very concerned from a diplomatic and a human rights point of view about where things could get worse, where governments who've signed up to the war against the terrorism are using this affidavit from the West to crush even more than they previously did their own people, be it in Central Asia, or be it in the Arab world, or be it in Russia itself. So I think if we can stop things getting worse, and we have to talk country by country here, and including stop things getting worse here, where it's not legitimated, I think we'll be doing pretty well. To make things better, I'm not very optimistic. I'm very much in agreement with what the others have said about the clash of civilizations. I did write a book once called Islam and the Myth of Confrontation. There are days when my knees are slightly weak this, because I hear all this rhetoric and nonsense coming out, and from both sides. It takes two to have a clash of civilizations, and that's what we've got at the moment. I see no way in which this garbage is going to be swept out of the press or swept out of the public discourse. I do think that we have an obligation to put it in football terms, to stay on the field, to keep on making our points. And that includes insisting that the only basis for addressing human rights violations of individuals or nations or whatever is on the basis of certain universal principles, which are there in the Charter, in the 1948 Universal Declaration, and that even such apparently benign phrases as dialogue of civilizations contain their own surreptitious agenda. Because dialogue of civilizations implies there are incompatible or fundamentally different value systems, and we might talk to each other and find a compromise. But we've moved beyond that. This is a covert way of protecting various forms of authoritarian definition of culture. And we have to subject the different civilizations, whether it's the right to hold guns, you know, and all capital punishment in the US, or gender practices in countries, or some of the appalling treatment of children in this country, we have to subject all of these not to dialogue of civilizations, but to universal interrogation. But I ain't optimistic, and for sure, Huntington and all the fanatics in the East and in the West who subscribe to him have made a lot of mileage, and we'll go on making mileage out of this crisis.
Thank you. Before asking two or three more, I think I ought to call attention to one of the dimensions we've not yet had time to say much about. You see before you people on the platform who are even-handed in their pursuit of human rights. Principle of that objective, as it were, is embodied in some of the people around me on the platform. But I think that some of us would want also to add the longer term denial of human rights through forms of economic exploitation and impoverishment that we've got in trying to sum up the situation. We've got to try and ask why it is that Fred has suggested the sort of even-handed need to analyze the religious base or faith upon which so many people rest, but also to ask seriously about the countries which are involved themselves up to the neck in forms of exploitation which are increasing inequality in the world and increasing the degree of impoverishment within which women are undoubtedly affected, but this also applies to disabled, elderly, and other people, and we need to recognize that an example I had recently of visiting New York and seeing the discussions going on at the UN, yes, there are a lot of bureaucrats who keep their head down and just issue the same old round phrases which are very boring, but there are also those who understand some of the concessions and some of the admissions that have to be made on all sides about fault and about the ways in which developments in, let us say, the American attitude to taxation is, as it were, exposing them to ridicule in relation to the need for, let us say, an international financial tax on international financial transactions. So we do witness, while I was there, the American Congress had passed a bill to repeal all payments of income tax by multinational corporations for the last 15 years. This had actually been passed by Congress and is now being considered by Senate. So we have a situation where, in looking at the longer term reconstruction of not only human rights but of social relations, we have to remember that there are lots of concessions, as in the Israeli-Palestinian debate, that concessions have to be made on both sides about fault. Let's have two or three more questions.
My name is Jim Kennedy. May I ask Professor Halliday to comment on two points? In the debate yesterday of what I might call Mr. Blunkett's bill, how do you explain the fact that despite the intensity of the debate, those who actually voted against were only five? Secondly, do you not feel that by the cosmeticizing pablum influence sometimes of the political correctness issue, that we are in fact avoiding confronting with that very directness that we should some of these fundamental issues? You used a football analogy.
Well, the first question is really for Francesca, I think.
Do you mind us just taking a couple more questions? I think it makes it easier for everybody to feel they get through a lot.
I was going to raise, my name is Suzanne Long from the United Nations Association. I was going to raise a slightly backwards way on the point that Peter Townsend made. How convinced are the panel that the causes of terrorism do lie with poverty, health, i.e. the economic and social human rights, given that Bin Laden apparently is a millionaire and other people involved don't seem to be short of the odd penny? Is this argument, or to what extent is this argument valid, that terrorism arises from poverty, lack of health, etc., etc.?
And thirdly, sir.
My name is Kim Schwani. I'm a fellow student. I wonder why not the intelligence, British intelligence and American intelligence, they didn't take a measure of security measure before Al-Qaeda terrorist organization to bomb the trade market in New York on September 11. That's my first question. And secondly, why not West European Union and United Nations, instead of they sending a military force to Afghanistan, why they didn't establish a human rights program there and bring in, introducing democratization and human rights to Afghanistan? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm afraid I didn't hear all the questions. I think some of the acoustics just this corner, but I'll answer the first question if you like, and let other people answer some others, which is about why only five people voted against the bill yesterday. I mean, I enjoyed the headline in The Guardian, it said something like, you know, bill trounced, and then you look under and you see five people voted against.
I mean, obviously, a lot of that is to do with the whipping system. Some of it's to do with tactics. I think if the Lib Dems didn't abstain this time, they're going to. There were a number of prominent Labour spokespeople who did actually put up amendments but didn't want to vote against because they want to keep their chairpersonship of their committees, etc. But I think, you know, one of the things that worries me is the kind of unhealthy polarisation of this debate, which doesn't really help us understand what a human rights response is. And I suppose that's what I was trying to get at. I mean, you know, Brian Sedgemoor, the MP for Hackney, I mean, he made the point this is the most draconian legislation since the 1790s, when the government of the day was trying to fight Tom Paine. That was a great soundbite. You know, I enjoyed the point. I read those debates of that era. But, you know, it really worries me if, you know, Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden are being compared to Tom Paine. And that, you know, this knee-jerk civil libertarian response, which is a perfectly respectable response, and one I have been part of myself in my life, isn't a human rights response, in my view, to the events of September the 11th and this legislation. I do think one has to think, you know, what would you do if you were Home Secretary? And tomorrow, you know, Canary Wharf or the Holborn Tube could be full of sarin gas. You know, canisters were found in an Al-Qaeda house, according to a respected Spanish journalist who just lost his life in the process of telling us that. You know, what would you do if that happened and you had done nothing? That's a sensible, it's not just a sensible and responsible question, it's a human rights question. My concern is that what he has done, as Kate was saying, is in fact not addressing that issue, but in fact addressing an issue that existed before September the 11th, which was a number of governments in the Middle East putting pressure on him to prosecute people who were actually objectors to other regimes for other reasons, for whom there wasn't sufficient evidence to prosecute them. They've already widened the anti-terrorist laws to deal with that, so that you can prosecute here somebody who has carried out an offence abroad. We've now gone very far. We could even go further down that road. But to actually detain people without trial for an indefinite period of time is one of the most draconian measures a government can take. And what worries me is that it doesn't even address in particular the issues that we're facing.
Thank you.
Any other member of the panel want to react?
Well, shall I just answer one or two?
Yeah, do.
I mean, quickly, on political correctness, I'm in favor of political correctness, if by that is meaning getting prejudiced language on class or race or gender or anything else, or even people who have university degrees and who don't, out of our language and out of our press. And by, we've got a long way to go in this country. But if it means tolerating violations of human rights on the grounds that they're by religion or by oppressed peoples or by self-proclaimed liberation groups, no. And I think in that sense, you're right. And I would repeat, I think it is shocking that in the 5 years they were there, as far as I know, nobody in London ever organized a demonstration against the Taliban. And similarly, the kind of racist stuff coming out of some of the mosques was not confronted by the press or by the Home Secretary or by anybody else. So I think there is an issue there. I don't think it's an issue of political correctness. On the question of poverty and terrorism, my one sentence answer is that poverty and the effects of globalization were not a cause of September the 11th, but they certainly explain much of the international reaction and consequences. Why is it that many people around the world think the Americans had it coming, Bin Laden's not such a bad lad, they've got a taste of their own medicine, or at least we shouldn't go along with their response? I mean, that is a very widespread view, and in places where there's no Islam, like Brazil, or Hindu India, or China. So I think that if you want to manage the consequences of September the 11th, these issues have to be addressed. But having said which, as with Palestine, as with Kashmir, as with Iraq, these issues should be addressed on their own merits, not because we got a wake-up call on September the 11th. And finally, why did they not foresee it? I think that they didn't foresee it partly because, like everybody else, they didn't really believe it would happen. If they got a warning about a bomb in a major supermarket or in Bush House, they would have responded. If you're told that a plane is going to be attacking a skyscraper, you just discount it. And secondly, they were looking in the wrong place. They were monitoring people from North Africa. They were not monitoring people on Saudi visas or from Saudi Arabia. So I don't think this is a conspiracy theory, but there was certainly a serious error of judgment.
I would just perhaps to the second question, I'd like to just add a bit more to what Fred stated, and that is to do with the issue of change. The panel have made evident the fact that human rights, the pursuit of human rights, is a continuing business that will no doubt go on for generations because circumstances out there economically and socially change. And what I was trying to get to, without wanting to suggest this was the first priority in terms of immediate action, was that there are layers of cause or explanation which we keep having to unpeel. And that in my experience, the central point about social polarization, which is frankly the central point about social change and international change with globalization of the markets, is a phenomenon which we've got to find some better understanding of so that we can call the cry of halt. The degree of inequality between first and third worlds and between rich and poor within each country is growing in most countries and between most of the major regions of the world. And this can become a flashpoint because the search for an adequate standard of living, which is enshrined in the Declaration of Human Rights and in some of the other conventions of the rights of the child too, this is felt by many to be frustrated by their inability to control or even have a voice in the low wages that are set, in the denial of employment and so on. And there are frustrations which build up and which seem to me to provide the kind of recruiting house for the instruments of Al-Qaeda and others, as well as for the kind of reaction to exploitative behavior which we see on a very substantial scale at the present time. And I don't think we can remove this structural, let's say, more comprehensive analysis or complete analysis of social development on the grounds that this is all too complex and too difficult. We've come just about to 1:30. Is there one last burning question which somebody would like to ask before we close? One up, that's good, on the top deck.
Hello, my name is Shubho, and I want to ask that I want to first say that after the 11th of September, some of the states seem to be in a hurry of enacting anti-terrorism bills, and one of them is India, and the new Prevention of Terrorism Act, which is supposed to be enacted in a few days, has quite a few draconian rules, which of course would suppress civil liberties of Indians in a big way. I would like to ask Professor Halliday, how do you see India amidst the whole crisis? Because Kashmir had been a burning issue for a very long time, and now the US has banned quite a few terrorist organizations. Do you think that India has gained some political mileage out of it?
Well, very quickly, yes, India has gained some mileage, but India, again, we must look at what was happening before September the 11th. India was gaining a lot of mileage already, partly because its relations with America were improving militarily and strategically, but also because of the whole opening up of the Indian economy to the internet world, the dot-com world, and so on, in a very spectacular way. In some ways, Pakistan has now maneuvered itself into a more favorable relationship with America, which may or may not last. And India could then be a partial loser. My worry, the deeper worry, as I hinted before, is I see no prospect at all of a sensible shift by either India or Pakistan on the Kashmir question. We're even further away from a settlement on Kashmir than we are on a settlement on the Arab-Israeli question. At least in the Arab-Israeli question, there is a document, a reasonable document, which both sides once signed, which if they return to would be the basis of a just and stable peace. In Kashmir, we haven't even got near that, and both governments are behaving in a very irresponsible way.
Well, thank you for coming and joining in this discussion.
Thank you.